90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby. Welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Hale, and with me today is Brandon. You and I both have some interest in aesthetics, and in particular, I have a very fleeting interest in architecture, that being the general design and look, and to some extent, the functionality of the structures that we live in and utilize. It's obviously a very varied discipline. Massively so, both in what people design and in terms of literally the size of the designs themselves, all the way from effectively you could maybe say like a cabin or maybe even something like a doghouse, all the way to skyscrapers and giant government buildings and offices.
As far as genres of art go, architecture seems to be the most substantially varied, at least.
Oh, for sure. It's hugely varied, and it's also long been kind of controversial in some ways, because, you know, we're going to get into this quite a bit, but there's a real pull in architecture that there isn't in a lot of other disciplines, especially disciplines that would be considered art forms, because, you know, for a lot of art forms are for, or I would say most, are in a sense for the sake of themselves. They are for the sake of their, you know, enjoyment or observation or whatever it might be, right? In a sense, you might say the beauty is the main purpose, right? Whereas architecture obviously is, we're designing something that is deeply functional, but also potentially beautiful. And so there's often this tension in architecture in terms of like, what is it really about? Is it more of a design engineering aspect, or is it an art form to create beautiful spaces?
There's certainly that tension in architecture. And I think that is its variety, is because when you think about art and art serving, well, this might be it serving its own purpose, art for art's sake, but art for the sake of the aesthetic experience, architecture seems difficult to conceive of as just a purely aesthetic thing. Like, what would a purely aesthetic building look like? A building creates a kind of space, and it always seems to serve some function, some practical purpose. So you have this inherent tension in this medium that gives it a lot of its variety, but comes with a lot of theoretical disagreement.
Absolutely. And you know, there's been periods of time where, you know, the beauty of architecture, the aesthetic of architecture has really predominated what, you know, it is about. And then particularly more in the modern era, that's transitioned more to architecture being more about functional spaces. And at best, how do we make, you know, functional spaces at somewhat visually appealing? Or do we reject that altogether and make them as ostensibly as functional as possible, as that being their pure, you know, drive? And so we're going to get into all that a little bit. You know, for our listeners, this is like going to be a pretty casual, interesting conversation. I will say that a lot of what we're going to be drawing on today comes from Elaine de Bonin's more recent book, The Architecture of Happiness, which deals particularly with a kind of mixture of the history, aesthetics, and philosophy of architecture. I really recommend it for anyone who is interested in the topic. It's very accessible, and it has a lot of really interesting illustrations and stuff to demonstrate what he's talking about. Again, that's The Architecture of Happiness. We're also going to be working off a lot of an interview from the, or at least bringing it up a bit because I think it's great, interview from the late 1950s with the famous American designer Frank Lloyd Wright, who had some very strong opinions about architecture and very much was doing his own thing, which I appreciate. And then as well, I know you're drawing quite a bit off some work by John Dewey and his aesthetic.
Yeah, John Dewey has a work by, or he has an aesthetic work called Art as Experience, which isn't about architecture per se, but I found that John Dewey's treatment of architecture would be relevant here because he doesn't give it a, he doesn't have a hierarchical kind of, like most, you know, modern aesthetic thinkers, he doesn't lay out a hierarchy and say, okay, architecture is at the top. But in what we talk about today, he is going to kind of place the architectural as inherent to or locatable in all kinds of aesthetic experiences. So I thought it would be an interesting thing to bring to the table.
Yeah, I think that sounds super interesting. It'll be perfect for what we're talking with. Perhaps a good starting point for our discussion, and then we'll just kind of see where it takes us a little bit, is really talking a little bit about the history of architecture. I want to say this is going to be super, for our listeners, this is going to be super generalized. You could go way deeper into this. Anything we're going to be talking about today obviously can be delved in much deeper. But really, architecture is quite interesting because the exemplars of beauty that were held up within architecture for a long time really stayed quite consistent for almost two millennia. And that really is the architecture of the, you know, the classical period. So we're talking Greek and Roman architecture in particular. You know, think of Doric columns, temples, pitched buildings, pantheons, domes, you know, Colosseum-esque, you know, amphitheaters and that sort of thing.
Yeah, arches. A very classical architectural vocabulary. Yeah,
a very classical architectural vocabulary. That's a great way of putting it. And that really stayed the paradigm of what was considered beautiful architecture right up until even the beginning of the 20th century. When we look at, obviously, buildings change, materials change, things become, you know, we obviously, you know, improved some of our techniques and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, one only could something like, say, the White House in the United States or the Capitol building, to look at, you know, many of the great, this is particularly true of government buildings and things like that, great large pieces of public infrastructure and architecture, which were really considered to be the palettes for where architects could transform, like, something into being effectively a work of art. And the only accepted paradigm of that for a long time was more or less having some sort of neoclassical style. If you were going to make a beautiful building, it was going to have columns. It was going to, you know, be sort of long and drawn out. It was going to be kind of temple-like. It was going to be impressive. It was going to be imposing. It was going to be elegant. It was probably going to be made out of marble or granite, or made to look like it was made out of marble or granite. And that really was the style. That really was the paradigm. And people might say, okay, well, what about the architecture of the everyday in that period, right? So we're talking about from the classical era right up until early modern industrial revolutionary period. And really, actually, localized architecture is a lot, and what we call everyday architecture. So basically, we were talking about your shops, your homes, perhaps your place of work, depending on where you live, although most people, frankly, worked outside because most people were in agriculture. What you see in these places, particularly because so much of the world lived, including Europe and wherever else, Western world, lived in some sort of level of extreme poverty, effectively, or subsistence life, is that the architecture was more or less determined quite clearly by the bounds of what was available to those living in those spaces. That's a way of saying, you know, particular architectural styles, whether, let's say, you were in the UK, Sweden, or the Middle East, very much reflected what building materials and tools you had on hand. You know, a classic example to think about might be in areas that had a lot of timber and were also very cold, you know, things like in Nordic countries, you know, log and timber frame homes were kind of the norm. Whereas if you move into areas like, let's say, North Africa and the Middle East, you get a lot more sort of stone-based buildings and stuff like that. And, you know, I've even seen this for myself, you know, interestingly, actually, as I say this, it makes me think a little bit about my time when I was in Ethiopia. I was traveling through, obviously, some very arid areas of that country. And people had a very unique, people still there, by and large, were living in subsistence agriculture. And people lived primarily in what I would call basic stone houses, because they lived effectively in an arid area where stone, a mountainous arid area where stone was very plentiful. And so it was very easy for people to, still to this day, build these sort of stone homes that almost look, to be honest, a little bit like Italian villas in a way, a little bit more crude, to be honest, but they were actually quite interesting looking, but they're very clearly rooted in their location. They look that way because that's what's available, that's what's possible, and they are, in fact, quite functional. They might actually look quite interesting, but that was, like, the primary reason that they are the way they are. It was not until the kind of, like, late 18th, but especially the 19th century, you start to see architecture deviate, especially public and large-scale architecture. Again, I'll emphasize, a lot of what we're going to be talking about, although it will get to the more personal, it will get to, like, perhaps even your home today, what is that like? A lot of the history of architecture is more related to these larger institutional government, state, and honestly, the homes of the wealthy, because that's where this sort of artistic expression and experimentation could come about, primarily because of cost, right? It's oftentimes these new ideas are quite expensive. And complex to do. But really, in the 19th century, especially in the homes of the wealthy, you start to get late 18th and early 19th century, you start to get more experimentation and a step away from the neoclassical style. And really what people start to do, especially and enter the kind of romantic era, is, again, wealthier people start to hearken back more to an idealized medieval and society and start inculcating Gothic themes into homes. And there's some quite famous country and estate homes in England that at the time were very radical because they deviated away from this imperialistic style and went with, you know, a much more Gothic pseudo cathedral type look. As a home, as a space. I mean, these are palaces. Homes is a term used loosely, but you start to see that transition. So that's one where you start to see a jump off. And obviously, for our listeners, this gets more complicated than that. But the point where we'll kind of stop our story and is perhaps most important as, you know, you start to see some deviation away from classical architecture being the norm. People beginning to experiment more, and these homes tend to, and especially with this deviation, got quite, for lack of a better way of saying it, gaudy, got quite eccentric, got quite, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't think of it right now. If it comes to me, I'll let everybody know. But they got ornate. They got very, very, very ornate. And if anyone's familiar with something like Gothic cathedrals, like the cathedral in Cologne or Notre Dame in Paris, you know, these are very ornate, complex buildings. And this starts to be reflected in that. And as well, the imperial era or neoclassical buildings were also quite ornate in their own way as well. And so architecture becomes quite ostentatious in the 19th century. But this also compounds with a period of technical innovation, modernization, and in particular, you know, the school, the very generalized school of thought of modernism, right? Which, as you and I were talking about, for a little secret for the listeners, Brandon and I often talk a bit before the show, so we don't go completely blind. There's a very distinctly utilitarian or consequentialist bent to modernism, right? And by utilitarian or consequentialist, we mean, you know, what is important are the outcomes of an act, or in this case, perhaps some sort of creation, right? And generally speaking, for the improvement of one's life or society or whatever it might be. So basically, there starts to be a big rift. You could call it a rift between those of architecture and that of engineering, where, you know, our living spaces, our working spaces, our governmental spaces, our spaces of worship really come under scrutiny for being ostentatious, for being over ornate, for whatever it might be. And in fact, you know, the most important thing we should be focusing on is functionality. Let Let the function determine the form. Simplicity is what's most important. If it's a home, ask ourselves what makes a good home, you know, and check off these boxes and let the design flow from that. If it's a government building, if it's an office building, okay, make a list of what do we actually need? What does this building need to do? What makes the most sense? Let that drive the design. And anything that's there just effectively is drapery, unnecessary, and in fact, it might be ugly. And I think we'll take a pause and we'll have discussion because this tension really is important for the whole discussion that we're going to have today.
Yeah, I mean, it comes right back to the... I don't know what the term it would be, but the kind of inseparability between the utility and the aesthetic qualities of a building. And modernism in architecture really reduces a building to its function. And it says, well, you've got these aesthetic qualities, but they're actually quite extraneous. They cost money, or they might interfere with function, or that we just don't want to have to include this in the process of building a building. But I'm trying to think of how to tie this into introducing Dewey's theory, because Dewey would say that that might be true. You can have this distinction between a form and its function, but at the same time, he would question whether the appreciation of something is not a function that something can serve. And that's where he starts. That's where he starts chapter 10 of art is experience, that really art is, he says, art is a quality of doing and of what is done. So that's already inherently functional in a certain way. When you appreciate a work of art, you're actually engaged in a process of working up an experience. And he says that if you look at a lot of theories of art, there's this confusion between the product of art and the work of art. So the product is just the material, right? A building in our case that we're talking about. But the work of art is the artist's process of going through and working through the material. So a painter takes their acrylic and takes a stroke to their canvas, sees what it does, and then acts accordingly. Artists don't just kind of willy-nilly it. They do express themselves, but it's more or less an unlocking of the material that they're working with. The end result is a product, but that process is the work of art. And an observer of a work of art for Dewey is someone who is going to sort of recreate that work that goes into the production of a product, right? So an artist paints a painting, and they see that certain elements arranged in certain ways, and the observer is going to reconstruct that process. They're going to notice that, oh, this element is here for this reason. They use this color because it serves this function. And that continual working through of the work of art is the experience that is the aesthetic experience. Dewey says that architecture is actually positioned to be an exemplar of this facet of art because a building is a space. It's not something that you can instantaneously grab, right? This is one thing that he kind of goes on at length to criticize is this idea of the flash of instantaneous aesthetic grasp that sees the painting all at once, and it's an aesthetic revelation. He says it's not really like that. If you look at your experience of engaging with any kind of work, and a building shows this. You have to go through a building. You can't see the space all at once. You go into one room and you observe what it does. But not only that, you have to observe it over time. So, and that doesn't just mean the platitude that, sure, it takes time to go through the building, but you have to go to a building during the summer, go to the building during the winter, go to it in the rain, go to it when you're in a certain mood. Go to it when you're in a different mood. Go to it when you're a different age. Those are all different ways of working up an experience. Architecture is particularly posed to do that. So the other thing about this is that because and this is just a general aesthetic theory of Dewey, but it applies to his architecture specifically, is that the thing is that since it's the materials, the product that guide the experience, and those materials have different qualities, the materials are the materials kind of loan to different strains or tendencies of experience. But since qualities are like not exactly dividable or subdividable in any clear way, it serves more of a continuum than, say, okay, architecture is different than sculpture, is different than painting. You have all of these material elements, but architecture uses stone just as much as sculpture does, so they form more of a continuum, but they do exploit different tendencies in our experience. So distinctions are still useful, but don't think that you can get to these definitive classifications. So with that in mind, Dewey wants to emphasize a couple things about the medium of architecture. And one of the first things he says about architecture is that it is the most close to the materials that it uses. So in a painting, when you're working with acrylic, acrylics are actually a very synthetic material, right? A fresco is also a very synthetic material. It needs to be very prepared. If you're building a timber building, you do have to process the wood, but in a certain way, you're getting very, very close to wood as an aesthetic material. When you use stone and you put cobblestone in a road, or you use wood and whatnot, even synthetic materials like steel and brick still feel natural. We feel like we're encountering something that is in its state that it should be. So architecture gives us the material that we're to work with in its rawest form. The other thing too is that it employs, not only does it employ the materials that are closest, but the energies. He uses this vague term energies, but I think it's quite intelligible if you go to a building and you notice what a column is doing. Like, I remember when I was learning about the distinction between various Greek columns and noticing the effect that each of them has, right? If you look at a Doric column, it looks a little bit squished. It's containing the weight of the roof, the temple, different than a Corinthian column, which looks quite light, right? So architecture, by bringing us as close as possible to the original materials, actually reveals the way that things are held up, of thrust and counter thrust, gravity, light, time, all of these qualities that manifest as, he calls them energies, we meet very closely and very directly. There isn't a mediation between the light entering through a window and us. We simply encounter the light, but in an aesthetic scenario, right? Now, but the other thing that Dewey says about this, so we have these raw materials, but architecture is specifically posed to exemplify durability, right? So when you construct a building is, it wouldn't make sense to build a building if it wasn't going to last. So it just makes sense on that level. But it also exemplifies durability in the aesthetic, energetic, qualitative sense. Dewey says that architecture records and celebrates, more than any other art, the generic features of our common human life. We embody our form of life in our architecture. And he does counter that, okay, there has been this tendency, and because he's writing at the beginning of the 20th century or mid to early 20th century, so he's in the midst of this debate. He says that, sure, you can have aesthetic theories that kind of strip away the functionality or strip away the aesthetic qualities, but they're really missing the fact that the values, the human values that are embedded in a community, are the substrate, are kind of the reinforcement, are the support for the values that get built into these buildings, because these buildings embody durability. They embody the desire of man to live on through his deeds. So while certain theorists are divorcing theory, or they're divorcing the practical from the aesthetic qualities of architecture and buildings. Dewey recognizes that human use actually has aesthetic element to it, right? Like, think about the different, like, it's kind of exemplified in your example of Ethiopian local architecture, but he thinks also of the fact that if a work of art is a product of working through an experience or a material, when a person builds something like a castle for purely utilitarian reasons of defending their, defending their court, or building barracks to house armies, or a granary to store grain, it still has an aesthetic quality because it is the human interacting with their environment for the purposes of human life. So it still has that aesthetic quality of bringing a product to completion through work and working through the human condition, right? So this distinction between pure practical use and aesthetic qualities is not something that Dewey would say you can actually make a total divorce of. In order for this to happen, you have to have those underlying... He's not very particular about this, and I think this is where we might get into a discussion, but he's not particularly clear about what he means by human values, but he does say, look, something like a factory, no matter what kind of beauty you try to imbue to it, will always have something kind of devoid in it. It will always have something missing because there's something missing at the level of human values, right? It is just like trying to, you know, we have this saying of putting lipstick on a pig or something like that. He says also with banks and whatnot, if you want those buildings to actually be beautiful, you have to reshape the form of life itself that is living into that building. That's more or less, and also, sorry, the reason that Dewey kind of places architecture, again, I'm not saying hierarchically, but he does prioritize it in a certain way, is because the durability that architecture exemplifies is a feature manifest in anything that shows structure whatsoever. And all art is the structuring of a particular aesthetic experience. And so the architectural really is kind of a part of all aesthetic experiences.
Dewey touches on a lot of the points that De Bottom also really grapples with, and in particular, like, speaking about materials, but also to, like, you kind of highlighted it multiple times in there, that, you know, the form of what the building is, or let's just say the function of what it's doing, you know, why it's there effectively, its origin and its purpose, is and always will be reflected in the look and how we observe and interact with the space, whether we be on the outside or the inside, right? There's a reason banks don't look like, you know, rustic cabins by the lakeside, right? There's a reason office towers, you know, don't look like yurts, for saying it, right? Like, there's obviously a drive in what these things are that put them in a specific design category. But there's also, like, I think there's, as we were talking about earlier, and as Dewey's kind of highlighting, the aesthetic component, which can be beautiful or may not, is in fact inescapable. And it's found in the materials themselves, in how we use them, and how they're placed, and how people are allowed to pervade through and use the space, you know, and this is very much reflected in that idea of, like, a form of life, right? And as we were talking about with that tension earlier, I actually also found a little quote from a famous modernist architect who said, this was from Le Corbusier, if I'm pronouncing it, he was French, and he was a very famous French modernist architect who was really pushing, at one point, was really pushing this idea that, in fact, well, first of all, if I want to say the idea he was pushing was effectively kind of a lie, but I'm just going to preface and say it, but this idea that it's function that's driving design now, you know, we're in the future, we're modern people, we don't need to